Oregon Emergency Management called together a work group of the emergency management directors from the counties in order to get a better feel for the resources that they have in place and to report back to the committee at a later time as to exactly what they found out is there and already in place for afterward. So, any questions? Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I don't want to nitpick the language in this, but there are two things that I think beg comment, and that's one of them is prove that most communities are ill-prepared. I don't want to denigrate the hard work that a lot of communities have done, and I'm a little hesitant if this is going to go out over the signature of the chairs. I'll stop wordsmithing if it's going to be a reflection of the attitude of the community. I don't want to, by accident, denigrate the work that has been done. The other thing is, I'm not quite sure that I know in the next to the last line of the first paragraph what holistic means in this case. I would hope that we would try to capture some of those basic tools that are necessary, and I hate to say that Clatsop County is one of the people who have failed to have a hazard mitigation plan that has made them ineligible for some FEMA funds. But I just want to be careful about definitionally what it is we're asking this work group to do. And other than that, I think an expression from this committee to Mr. Murphy to form such a group to assess against a common template what exists in counties would be a very good thing.
Okay. Would you be satisfied if most was changed to many?
I would be fine with many.
All right. So any objections to that from any other committee members? Okay, if that's changed.
Madam Chair, but being the, English professor, I have wordsmithed this a little.
Okay.
If I could I'll just pass it over.
Be happy for you to. Let me finish, Senator Johnson.
I would change holistic to comprehensive, and hopefully that would give Mr. Murphy an opportunity to come in with those things that in his judgment and the professional judgment of his agency are those documents, those plans, those agreements without which a community could not begin to undertake rebuilding, let alone emergency response. And I'm sure there are some common documents. I don't presume to know what they are, but I think each county ought to have, at a minimum, a sort of chain of command or ought to have succession planning, or they ought to have some basic tools, and Mr. Murphy would be the best person to describe what those tools are.
All right, very good. Representative Nelson.
Yes, that's all I was just going to say. That's fine with me, and I just will resubmit this.
Okay, so holistic is fine, change to comprehensive.
Yes, ma'am.
And most would be changed to many. And having those changes, are there any objections? If not, the memo will be sent. All right, next on our agenda today is House Bill 2814. We have seen this bill before. I'm going to call Representative Boquist up and have him tell us just a little bit about the bill to refresh everyone's memory. And also, we need to talk about the Dash 3 amendments. Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, distinguished members of the committee. You've seen this several times. In fact, you've seen a Dash 2 amendment and a Dash 1 amendment. Dr. Allen and I have been working together to try and identify those critical shortfalls that we have across the state in the counties, how we address those in terms of a small-scale, medium-scale, or other type of pandemic. Well, Dr. Allen and I are in complete agreement of how we need to proceed. The challenge, two challenges that we all face in life in this building is the relating clause wasn't what either Dr. Allen and I specifically liked. We would like to make it broader. And in discussions, multiple discussions with legal counsel downstairs, their interpretation of what we were saying and their writing of what it was sometimes did not necessarily match. So what you have before you now is the Dash 3 amendments, which is as close as Dr. Allen and I can get legislative counsel to where we're trying to go. The goal is to be able to have the state in some level start preparing for a pandemic event. And if you recall, we've had multiple discussions here at this committee about the types of materials, the medical supplies, the masks, the type of EMT training, the types of sanitation items, that would need to be acquired. What we're asking you to do is to take the dash three and put it into 2814 and send it to rules so we can finish working it there. That's what's on the signed off by the president and by the speaker. And then, of course, we'll work it in rules committee and send it downstairs. And as Dr. Goldberg and I and Dr. Allen and I have agreed, if we get 50 cents more than we have when we get out of this building, that's 50 cents more than we have. If we get $50, then we can start down that road. And that's kind of where we are right there, Madam Chair. I'd be delighted to take questions.
Thank you very much for briefing us on that. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2814. Yes.
I move the dash three amendments to House Bill 2814.
Representative Nelson moves the dash three amendments to House Bill 2814. Are there any objections? No objections? Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2814-3 as amended refer it to the Rules Committee for further consideration.
Representative Nelson moves that the bill as amendment, as amended with the dash three amendments, be moved to rules. Is there any discussion? Representative Krieger?
Sent a bill to rules out of judiciary. When it got down there, they had less votes to get it out than we had in judiciary. And so I don't want it to go down there and die, and it's important that all the dialogue we've had regarding this, that they have it so they understand, because they've never heard any of the testimony on the issue. So you've got quite a bit of work to do, I think, down there to get it across to what we're trying to achieve and the importance of it. And I'm fine with it. Just make sure that it doesn't go down there with uninformed people on that subject.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to state on the record that I was not in support of the bill in its original format. Had some real concerns about simply purchasing vaccine that we might not be able to get out in a timely manner or that might expire. So I appreciate the work that's gone into the adjustments and with the additional changes. I can support this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to point out, though, that this also provides purchasing personal protective gear for 133,387 first responders. And I'm sorry, maybe I have the wrong. Okay, retract that. I still support it. More than
Marcette.
We didn't want to do it exact.
Well, I agree totally with Representative Krieger's logic in terms of sending it to a place where they know nothing about it and probably will not move it. Why doesn't this go to Ways and Means?
Why does it go to Ways and Means? It's a funding bill.
It's appropriating a little over $1.9 million.
The question is, why does it go? Why be a real rule?
It's a hearing.
Why not to Ways and Means directly?
It was my understanding that Representative Boquist needed another hearing on it. We didn't have it within our schedule, and the direction I received was to hold a work session and refer it to rules so it could have another full hearing.
Representative Boquist, was that your understanding?
Madam Chair, I think my best response to that would be, politely, is that I think in order to get the two signatures that are on that cover page there to allow us to do this, they decided it should go to rules.
I see. We had to get two signatures in order to have the work session today. And so, Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I have sort of an interesting thought. one of the problems that this committee has suffered from all session is the fact that it has felt as though for some of us that were new, we're coming in a conversation that's already underway. And I know how annoying it's been to the chairs to have to bring some of us up to speed. I'm very sympathetic to the issue raised by my good friend Representative Krieger in sending this to rules, and I'm wondering if maybe instead of a due pass, we could send a little committee note along with it and indicate how long this bill had been vetted, how many times we've heard it. At least some expression from the committee that as it arrives at rules, this is not new news. Or maybe even in the extreme, we all show up when it goes to rules, so that at least there's an expression of the amount of work that has gone into this to bring us to this point. I hate to see a work product that Representative Boquist has struggled as hard to try to bring consensus. The committee's heard the bill over and over again. And I agree with Representative Krieger. Maybe we've all just been here so long we're starting to get too cynical. But I would like some expression of the committee's feelings towards and about the bill as it makes its way through the process.
All right. Thank you. Co-Chair Boone.
Now I'm ready. I hadn't read the rest of the story there. And I think that the point is that this latest amendment makes this bill more usable, in, if you will, instead of just buying the antivirals and then what if something didn't happen in the time before they expired. So that it's very important to note that the personal protective equipment that this would buy includes but not limited to gloves, masks, gowns, sanitation supplies, decontamination supplies, medical supplies, to provide personnel capacity sufficient to implement distribution of supplies and to train. This is really important, and I think that what Senator Johnson just said and Representative Krieger brought up, that we don't let this fall by the wayside at this point. And I'm willing to show up if it's scheduled, whenever it's scheduled, to support that as well as send a note with it or whatever we need to do to make sure this moves forward. Because I think the reason is because this is our last meeting today.
Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a functional reason why we're sent to rules and not ways and means? I mean, I understand the political. Was there a functional reason that was explained?
It's a process question. In other words, once you have to get the dispensation to hear it, which then it automatically goes to rules. So I think that we've had some good suggestions here. I think Senator Johnson's suggestion that we actually have something written that is sent to the chair and the committee on rules and then show up. I think we can do both. But okay, Representative Nelson has moved that House Bill 2814 move to the Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules as amended with a due pass recommendation and then to Ways and Means by prior reference. And the assistant will please call the roll.
Senator Larry York?
Aye.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Shoffman?
Aye.
Representative Kellen?
Aye.
Senator Gary George?
Excuse.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Chair Berger?
Aye.
Motion carries. Work session on House Bill 2814 is closed, and the right a number of votes to move the bill.
All right.
Thank you, Representative Boquist. All right. Next on our agenda today is something we've all looked forward to. I told the presenters that we've been talking about them when they weren't here, so it's nice to have them here today. We have the Amateur Radio Communications Plan and some nice people to testify for us. I'll call Vincent Van Der Hoek.
Van
Der Hoek. Vincent Van Der Hoek. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Chair Berger, Co-Chair Boone, members of the committee. My name is, for the record, I guess I state that my name is Vincent Van Der Hoek. I am the, I volunteer at Oregon Emergency Management as the volunteer emergency coordinator for their amateur radio unit for the past 2.5 years, something like that out there. With me today are Marshall McKillop from Oregon Emergency Management. He is the communications officer there. Also, Ms. Bonnie Altus, who is our state, the head of our state leadership for the section known as the Oregon section. She represents our national organization, the American Radio Relay League, and is elected by members of that organization at the state level. Also, we have with us Mr. Dean Davis, who is the emergency manager, emergency coordinator for our amateur radio unit for Marion County. Again, I'd like to thank very much the committee for this opportunity to come and talk about the role of amateur radio and emergency communications. We have looked forward to this day for a very long time, and I guess, to my surprise, you have too. So will that try to get on here with a brief PowerPoint presentation about amateur radio and emergency communications that we can perform, and then we can get into what I think is probably of most interest to you, the communications plan that you have sitting on your desk there. So I have, there are a set of PowerPoint slides here that I'll run through that requires, I'm afraid, that some of you kind of swivel around to,
all right, very
to see
good.
These things.
Can you turn off the light right there?
Somebody able to do the, bring the lights down for us? Okay, that's good. Amateur radio, normally or usually known as ham radio, has been around for quite some time now. Since the 1920s and the 1930s, we have engaged in a lot of emergency communications activities, and we'll talk about some of them. One of the reasons that we've been able, or some of the reasons really, that we've been able to engage in these communications and exercises and training is first that there are very large numbers of us out there. In the United States these days, there are 675,000 amateur radio operators in the United States. Worldwide, there's about 2.5 million. In the state of Oregon, there's almost 14,000 amateurs, and right here in Marion County, there's almost 1,000. Secondly, all of us have taken and passed an examination by the Federal Communications Commission to get a federal license. So we have some technical training in communications, electronics, having to know the rules and regulations as written down by the federal government through the FCC. Thirdly, we're very flexible. We take our communication system and build it as we go for the most part. Particularly in disaster and emergency settings, we're able to pick up our gear, move into an area quickly, get a communication system on the air, as rudimentary in the beginning as it may be. It works. Lastly, our systems tend to be relatively simple and very redundant. We're always looking for ways, new ways to perform these communication services, and that means that we've come up with a half a dozen or so different ways of doing it that support each other. In small emergencies, the conventional communication system seems to perform pretty well. If you have some flooding, or you have a small power outage someplace, or over in the eastern part of the state, you're more familiar with fire activities out there, the normal and conventional communication system seems to work pretty well. But in big emergencies, in disaster situations, those systems tend to become overloaded and have many points of failure, and all it takes for a lot of them is a single point of failure to bring that system down. Again, one of the things that hams are able to do is to have this redundancy built in and to have many points and many routes to route their communications. What would indeed happen out here on the coast, and my biggest fear for many years now has been that some morning we're going to have a 9.2 or a 9.1 off the coast, 50 or 60 miles. The earthquake itself will take down all of the communication systems and probably the power grid on the coast there. How are we going to get warning out there? How are people going to be notified? How are we going to do our rescue communications from the coast when all of that infrastructure is gone? And amateur radio is one of the ways that we can do that. After the power goes, and when things
like the cell phone system overload and that cell phone system disappears, then we have to have another way of doing things. The amateurs generally bring with them their own generators, their own power supplies, batteries. Some of us come in with solar panels and run that way. Very often we team up with either police or fire departments or emergency operations centers and operate off of their emergency generation facilities. We also have, in this state, many, many, many hundreds of amateurs with mobile units in their cars, so that they're mobile or portable kinds of operations where you can get out in the field, find the spot that you're assigned to, and provide communications from it, from your vehicle. So basically, we're different because we're less infrastructure dependent. We bring it with us, we make our own, and we create as we go. Okay. There's a long...
When you said the spot you're assigned to, who assigns you?
When there's a disaster, most of our units, what we call the Amateur Radio Emergency Service, most of those units are responsible to a county emergency manager and work for them. So those folks will go wherever that county emergency manager assigns them. Most of our work is in support of the county, out in the field operation. For my operation at the state level, I'm much more concerned with getting information from the county emergency manager into the state level, and then up the chain of command from Oregon Emergency Management up to FEMA or wherever it has to go after that. So we're dealing with kind of two separate levels of communication here, one at the county level in the local area and then one from the county to the state. Some of us have been around a long time. I've been in the business, if it is a business, for 48 years now, which is a lot longer than I thought it was going to last. But here I am, 65, and still doing this.
Time flies when you're having fun.
That's true.
Yes, and I could take the whole rest of the afternoon to tell you stories of things that one gets involved in with amateur radio. You end up with friends all over the world. And that's one of the interesting and nice things about it. If you go back far enough, you might remember the 1964 Alaska earthquake, the Good Friday earthquake. One of the best stories I know is that when that earthquake occurred, the governor of the state of Alaska, sitting down there in Juneau, discovered that the Alaska State Troopers communication system was gone. His Department of Transportation system communications was gone. The Alaska National Guard communication system was wrong. And somebody tapped him on the shoulder and says, hey, this ham radio operator next door here has communications with your disaster team in the mayor's office up in Anchorage. What do you want to know? And essentially for about the next 3 weeks, the state of Alaska was run out of a ham operator's bedroom and basement and living room. One of the nice things that gentleman did for us was then to go to the town council and say, I want an ordinance on the statute book that says there shall be no restrictions on amateur radio antennas. Let them do their job. And the hams in the city of Juneau certainly appreciated that, because the higher you can put an antenna, the better we like it.
There are all kinds of
examples here that you can see. One of the most recent ones that got a lot of attention was the Shuttle Columbia recovery effort. When the Columbia broke up on re-entry, you might remember that the debris field was enormous. It covered a swath a couple of hundred miles wide and about 500 miles long across the state of Texas and into Louisiana. And the recovery people on that operation quickly discovered that the sheriffs couldn't talk to each other, the police departments couldn't talk to each other, the fish and wildlife people that were pressed into service, the federal agencies couldn't talk to each other. And the result was to take a ham operator with a handheld radio and put in those vehicles, and then all of a sudden you had statewide communications. Because we had, or they had in Texas, this statewide repeater network from mountaintop to mountaintop that the hams had gotten together over a 20-year period of time, constructed and paid for.
Okay. Yes, Ms. Senator Johnson.
You made a comment that was interesting, and I think you were trying to be jocular about it, but I think it's a great idea. You said that the higher the towers are, the more hams like it.
Yes.
My question to you from a technical perspective is, do you have to hang on the tower infrastructure by yourself, or can you be co-located with other devices that are hung on the superstructure?
For the repeater systems that we have on hilltops or mountaintops around, that the handhelds or the mobile units work through to relay from one part of the state to another, an awful lot of those are co-located with commercial sites on hilltops. I think here in the state of Oregon that we've co-located with a few state sites, but we sure would like to co-locate on some others. These hilltops are a precious resource.
Madam Chair, I hear that comment as a clarion call for this committee to help figure out the connect points with OWN and OPB. OPB is in the process right now of replacing lots of towers, and it seems to me that if there is an expression from the legislature suggesting to OPB that is doing this, hopefully, with public money or an infusion of public money, that there'd be some considerable enthusiasm to figure out how to accommodate you. And certainly the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network I maybe could use an expression from this committee about making sure that the amateur radio community is at the table when there's discussion about sites to see if there's an opportunity.
Yes, Senator, and I'd add to that that it would be nice to talk to ODOT as well, because they have a lot of sites. Oh, and the Forest Service, for that matter.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm really picking this up here. Did you say Vanderhyde?
Vanderhyde,
yes.
Yeah.
Beg your pardon?
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Vanderhyde, thank you. This is great. Because I don't understand this, I do understand aviation and communications, but I'm assuming this is similar to what we have in the Gulf of Mexico, tracking our helicopters going out, those
right.
Antennas, the Motorola set and all that. But could you just tell me, do we have a grid in the state of Oregon? If we had that 9.2 earthquake that wiped out the coast, is there a grid then further back that if then the towers were damaged, then does another set further back pick up 50 miles away? Or
yes, Representative, the system's pretty redundant. Going from the Portland area down the coast, the crest of the coastal mountain range, there's a set of probably 15 repeater sites that we co-locate with, mainly with commercial businesses, commercial outfits, because strangely enough, a lot of the technicians who work for those outfits are also hams, and they talk their employer into letting us co-locate our repeater network in some of these sites. If that tower and if that site survives the earthquake, and that's always an if, and their emergency power at that site comes back up, then we come back up. And, of course, not all of our communications are dependent on VHF radio. We also have high-frequency radio that we use. And we'll talk a bit more about that kind of system here.
I guess I just wanted to know before I left this meeting today that there is a way we can communicate, because I mean without that all the recovery efforts and memos and everything else we can write are kind of for naught.
Oh, yes, there
so we do no matter what have a way.
Yes, there is another system, and as a matter of fact we were going to do a demonstration of that, but now that we're down in the basement the radio doesn't get out of the,
out of
the basement very well.
Okay, well, I just want to thank you for that and whatever all you've done. I'm sure you've been a catalyst, and so thank you.
We're, as I say, about 14,000 of us in this state. We tend to be a little on the nerdy side and therefore very much interested in communications and technology. And building that kind of a network is a hobby to these people. So they sink untold dollars of their own into it, because then they get to sit and talk over it to other nerds like themselves. And that's a pretty good system. And if it's functionally fail-safe, in a lot of conditions it is, then in an emergency or disaster situation, that's a pretty good backup system to have.
Well, it's really great.
Let's see, did I skip one? Oh, we work with the National Weather Service, the Skywarn program. Mostly you see that out in the Midwest. Some of these guys will take television stations with them, their own handheld TV cameras, and broadcast back the progress of a tornado as it goes across the countryside, following it, chasing it. They're tornado chasers, and report back to the National Weather Service what the progress of that storm is. We also work a lot with the National Hurricane Center, and our experience with the hurricane business, I think, demonstrates four of the things that ham radio has been able to do pretty well. We've been able to help with preparation and pre-positioning of resources, help coordinate that by radio with the American Red Cross and the Salvation Army and those kinds of entities move into place who do not have their own communication systems. We often have gone in with first responders as the police and fire come back into the area and become active. Their communication systems are gone, and we bring ours in with us. We have portable repeater units that we can haul around. In this state, there are six caches of communications equipment specifically for us, much of which was provided by the state fire marshal's office a year or two ago. And that equipment can be moved into the area, as well as our own stuff that we haul around. Thirdly, we get involved in the coordination of recovery and rescue efforts. We go out with our handhelds and mobile radios and assist in those activities. And lastly, but hardly least, when the disaster is over, we handle an awful lot of health and welfare traffic from the victims of those disasters, trying to find family members or trying to let family members know where they are and what condition they're in. And hundreds of thousands of messages came out of the Katrina event around the United States and abroad that let everybody know what was going on, how family members were.
Mr. Vanderheide, I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Many catastrophic disasters happen immediately. You don't have any warning of
them. Right.
And so how is it that you have 14,000 people,
right,
but how is it that someone would necessarily be right on top of the disaster when it happens?
Well, Senator Berger, what usually happens is this. There are amateurs in your local community. I don't think there's a city, town, or village in the state of Oregon that doesn't have a ham operator close to it. Probably several right in that location. They have their own equipment. When we're called out, we will come into the area within 2, 3, 4 hours, depending on the distance, depending on, upon the impediments that we have, to get that equipment, get those people and support them, the local folks, and get that. We tend to be right on the scene. We live there. We live in those communities. There are communities, too. Let's see. Yes, we have hundreds of amateurs. In fact, during the Katrina thing, we had literally thousands of volunteers across the nation that cycled in and out of that Katrina area. We've been involved in some other fast reaction events other than 911. 911 was a biggie in the immediate New York area, downtown Manhattan, that sort of thing. But I remember, as some of you probably do, the May 1980 explosion up here of a mountain called St. Helens. The communications network that had been established to tie all of those observation points together was an amateur radio network. And the first inkling I had that something was wrong was the voice of a ham by the name of Johnson. I don't remember his first name anymore, who shouted into his radio, "Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it." And, of course, he was lost on the ridge up there next to the mountain.
Was his name John?
I don't remember his first
John
name.
John Johnson.
Yeah, I don't remember his first name anymore. But in about 15 seconds, we saw that mountain go up. The initial communications and coordination of that was all done by amateur radio. Because, again, the issue that we're facing is that fire districts and police jurisdictions and sheriff's offices and emergency medical response teams cannot talk to each other. They do not have the interoperability that we need. And, again, one of the solutions is to take a ham radio operator with his mobile unit or his handheld radio and put with those units, and then you do have communications between those units. We call it shadowing. And in an incident, command incident situation, for FEMA, for example, we follow these people around. And whenever they want radio out, we're able to do it for them.
In other words, you have someone who lives in Seaside who would be on the spot when
right.
something happened, and
right.
if he were unsafe or she were in safe ground, they could immediately get out, hopefully if the towers and the mountains didn't come through. But that would be the best opportunity to hear immediately what is going on.
Yeah, yes, Senator. That's essentially correct. One of the issues you always face is, do they survive the incident?
Do they survive?
Absolutely. If we have the 9.0 out there,
yeah.
we're facing something between 10 and 20 minutes before that tsunami comes ashore. In a lot of those coastal areas, that wave could come ashore. 13-meter wave, 40-foot wave, 50-foot wave wouldn't be unanticipated at all. If they're living in an area or can get to an area, assuming the warning time is adequate, and warning is another issue that we're real concerned about, then you have pretty much at least one communications link out of the area. And then we need to start to reinforce those links. One of the ways to reinforce those links is to work with our local National Guard, Air Guard outfits. There's one here in Salem, and we'd like to be able to work with them to put a radio package and a couple of amateur operators on the first helicopter that heads for the coast to pick up injured cases over there, so that within a couple hours, anyhow, of an incident, we'd have people on the scene. And we need to be able to work that kind of arrangement out with the Air Guard.
Just a quick follow-up. You also have people in between. You have some on the coast. You have some maybe 10 or 15 miles, 20 miles, 30 miles, so on.
Yes,
so you have people all over the place.
Yeah.
So you're going to get response from a number of sites.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Madam Chair? Oh, excuse
yes.
me. Representative Nelson?
I think Senator George was for me.
Oh, was he? Senator George.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me for being a little naive. Could you explain a little bit how you operate and don't talk over each other? Are there multiple channels that you work off of? How do you coordinate that multiple channels? How do you not just have 14,000 people talking all over each other?
Well, each one of the repeaters, each mountaintop, works on a different frequency pair.
Okay.
And most of them are operated also with a tone control that you feed in from your radio. So you tone up and work on a specific frequency pair. Then a lot of them are linked by UHF or other radio frequencies from mountaintop to mountaintop, so you can start linking these units together to get out of the area.
If I could, Madam Chair,
sure.
I guess what I'm understanding is functionally, let's say, for instance, I had one of those in my hand and you had one
right.
in your hand. We're talking to each other.
Yes.
Are we on a specific channel like a CB radio would be? Because I've never worked in it. How do we not talk over with several of the other members who may also have them, they're having a different conversation?
Well, we do that two ways. One is we assign specific frequencies to specific areas. And secondly, we have what's called a net control. That is somebody who's in charge of the frequency and controls the traffic on it. And before you can talk to somebody, you have to get the permission of that net control to talk. And they functionally control the movement of traffic then.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, like a traffic cop.
All right. Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Vanderhead, what would it take, rather than us delaying your having the authority or right or permission or money to already be in sync with the National Guard so tomorrow that we know we're protected in the state, what do you need to make that happen?
Well, I think that I attended last Thursday's session, sitting in the back room like a fly on the wall, and I thought that the notion of having the citizens committee, I forget exactly what the title of that is, to start doing that planning and coordinating that and draw in representatives from the Air Guard and other state agencies that we can work with and work out a statewide plan and coordinate these kinds of activities, that would be a very useful thing to do.
We'll follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up?
My concern is it could be tomorrow.
Yes.
And I mean, that's Representative Morissette, or Senator Morissette and Senator Verger's bill you're talking about, and we thought was a good one to begin with. We weren't the only one, see? My concern is that's something that's going to make everything perfect post disaster. We want preparation.
Yes.
Old Scout will be prepared. So I'm just worried that if that would wait too long and take too long. So what can we do now to be sure, no matter what, we can communicate? The reason I understand this is because in a project in Nepal, the way I talked with my crews there in the Himalayas was through a ham operator, Dr. Walt
right.
Dyke in McMinnville. So, it was critical because we did have an accident. But how can we do this now? What needs to be done?
I think that's a good question. I'd like to
to
think some of that
good,
through
right.
a bit more.
Okay.
I'd like to be in the position of taking somebody from OEM and probably Marshall McKillop over there to talk to the Air Guard people.
Okay.
I mean, the National Guard's in the same building OEM is.
Right.
We should be able to sit down with them anytime.
Right.
And
okay.
say.
Well, I'm willing to help. So.
Yeah. This is the kind of thing we need.
All right.
These kinds of agreements.
Chair Boone?
I just have a simple question.
What does HAM stand for? Is it an acronym? Or?
I think it goes back to the early British amateur radio operators where the professional communicators referred to us as being rather ham-handed, and we picked up the... We picked up the moniker that way. It's sort of strange. There are lots of things in this hobby that have odd origins.
Mr. Vanderhyde, have you tried before? It seems to me that maybe you've tried to work with the National Guard, and that has not been a receptive place.
Not in my tenure.
Okay.
One of the members of our unit, of our amateur radio unit at OEM, is indeed was the communications sergeant stationed in the building right there. So we had a liaison, but it tended to be at low level activity. It wasn't a formal agreement. It wasn't a situation where we knew exactly what we could do and what support we could get and what support we were expected to give.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to work those things out.
All right. Well, continue on. We have another presenter after you.
Okay. Yeah. I know I'm running way over time here in doing all this. But once you wind me up, the clock tends to run for me. Let's see. We do a lot of other things for training purposes. We get involved in races and parades and all those kinds of things. You might know the Cycle Oregon. All the communications activities on that is done by ham radio. We're involved in the Mount Hood to See bicycle and running and walk race that takes place. So we get some training and experience doing public service events, as well as hanging around waiting for a disaster to happen, to say nothing of with, as you folks will well know, with volunteers, you have to keep them engaged and busy and doing something worthwhile to keep your membership. And that's the kind of thing that we need to get more into. Well, this just talks about how long ham radio has been around. We've been around 100 years now and have great fun at it. We communicate in a variety of ways, and yes, the Morse code is still there. The old dots and dashes, I use it a lot myself, particularly when talking across the Pacific or across the Atlantic to friends of mine on one side of one ocean or another. When this notes on rocket scientists, almost all of America's astronauts and Soviet astronauts are ham radio operators. When they go up in the International Space Station, when they go up in the shuttle, they do training sessions and conversations with schools of children, telling them about the space program and what it's like to ride in space and all that. So they've all gotten, or most of them have gotten, ham radio licenses. Here we talk a bit about the RVers and the boaters. Any given time, there are hundreds and hundreds of sailboaters out in the Pacific or the Atlantic or the Caribbean, and they get all of their email through high-frequency digital radio in a ham radio network. And that's essentially the kind of radio network that we're putting together here in the state of Oregon, which is a combination of a very high frequency and a high frequency and the Internet. Wherever we can use the Internet, we do that to pass our email-type messages. And that traffic is all transparent to the email user. If you're sitting in an emergency operations center in Coos Bay or Gold Beach or Lincoln City or wherever, sitting down at your computer, you don't have to be a ham operator and know what you're doing. You're using what looks like to you a regular vanilla email program. The fact that it comes and goes by radio is entirely transparent to the user, and that's the kind of a system that we're trying to put together here. Well, some of us travel all over the world. One of my fun examples is the local chest cutter over here at Salem Hospital. Our chief of the emergency room is a ham operator, and he's always invited on some of these de-expeditions, we call them, to rare places in the world. Vanuatu and the Andaman Islands and South Shetland, because they always like to have a doctor along, and he qualifies, and he's a ham.
Oh.
So they haul him off on some of these places that you'd have to search pretty hard on a map to find them. FEMA, everybody knows, is the Federal Emergency Management Administration. They tell you you should be independent for 3 days, self-sustaining for 3 days. But during that 3 days, how are you going to talk to people? How are you going to communicate with people? And the way we're going to do that is through the ARES, or the Amateur Radio Emergency Service. This is an organization put together by our national body, the American Radio Relay League. And there's an older organization. It's a parallel organization that came around in civil defense days, known as the Radio Amateur Civilian Emergency Service. It grew out of the Second World War. And any one of the civil defense authorized agencies in the state at the county or the state level can put together one of these units. For years, we had something of a rivalry between the civilian side and the civil defense side. In the last 20 years or so, we've taken to combining these units into an ARES RACES unit with the same leadership and the same membership, so that if the president invokes the War Powers Act and regular ham radio goes off the air, the same set of operators and the same leadership just switches hats and becomes the emergency communications during wartime or declared emergencies. We have agreements with people like the Department of Homeland Security, American Red Cross, Salvation Army, a lot of other organizations, provide communications for them, as well as at the county level for the county emergency manager. Again, our state, our federal or national level organization, founded clear back in 1914. And that's about all covering that. At this point, I presume you'll either want to hear about what you've been given as the plan. That's a State of Oregon Amateur Radio Communications Plan, but it really isn't, and I suppose I ought to talk about why it really isn't. It's really our internal document for Oregon Emergency Management for our radio unit. There is no statewide amateur communications plan.
That's what I figured.
And part of the reason for that is that disaster planning and disaster communications in this state is assigned at the county level. So we're dependent on the county emergency manager working with their local emergency coordinator or their RACES officer to put together a plan. And so a lot of those plans, as they now exist, are very much out of date. We'd like to see those updated by the county emergency manager and by our local emergency coordinator. And when those come in, then we can put together for the state or at the state level a statewide communications plan, emergency communications plan, for the amateur radio operators. So I think I've used up more time than I should have already.
Well, let's see if you have some questions for you. Anyone questions for Mr. Vanderhyde? Yes.
Have other states, have operators in other states done this? Do you have
yes.
a model?
Yes. I don't think I've ever counted, but I think every state in the union has a an amateur radio unit.
No, a plan. A
plan?
Yeah, I mean, does somebody else have what you
yes.
just said we're lacking, is what
yes.
I'm asking.
There are state plans around. I have to say I'm not yeah. intimately familiar with any of them.
It would be interesting if we could see some of them or were aware of the model that you would like to do in Oregon, because I think that's, as far as I'm concerned, that is the basis of what we're doing. That's the bottom line. And we spent a lot of time and a lot of money on inoperability. We just, I think, wrote a check for a couple mil to have something done. And, you know, this, we need to know more about what
right.
you would like to have.
And I'll make it a priority of mine to make inquiries to the other states and see if I can come up with some of those state plans.
Yeah, that would be good.
Other questions? All right, thank you very, very
Go.
Much. I appreciate that. And we have two more people here in case that you were going to ask some complex questions. Did either of you want to have anything to say before we turn to the other presenter, Bonnie and Marshall? You want to come up and have anything to say, Bonnie? You might tell them what you do.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bonnie Altus. My call sign is AB7ZQ.
You need to talk into the microphone.
My name is Bonnie Altus. AB7ZQ is my call sign, and I've been a member of the Yamhill County ARES unit for about 11 years now. Which is the length of time that I've been licensed. Vince mentioned the Amateur Radio Relay League, and that organization is organized by state with volunteer officials at the state levels elected by the membership. And a year ago, I was elected by the Oregon ARL members as their volunteer section manager. And I'm very interested in what this committee is doing and would like to attend more of your meetings because people around the state have asked questions about it and have asked how amateur radio can be more widely recognized in the state. And I do have a contact, Senator Morissette had mentioned wanting to know what other states have done. And I do have an email list of everyone in my capacity throughout the United States and can find out if other states have been successful in putting something like that together. One problem that some of the states may run into in doing that is not all sections are statewide sections. And so states like California are divided up into about 12 different sections that may or may not work closely together. But in Oregon and a number of other states, a couple that come to my mind that have done a lot are Virginia, Colorado, and Michigan that are statewide sections that if anyone's done something like that, those would be the ones, and I can certainly find that out. But
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Well, when I watch the Weather Channel, I see Hurricane Alley, and there must be a pretty good, you know, plan for some of those states where the hurricanes pop up and go through them and so on and so forth.
Yeah. My understanding with Hurricane Katrina, a lot of
I meant tornadoes.
Oh, tornadoes.
I meant tornadoes.
Yes.
Excuse me.
Yes, I did hear from the Kansas section
Kansas,
manager
Nebraska.
Recently, and they had a very active network going with the tornadoes that went through there recently.
Yeah, and they do every year.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. More and more.
Yes, in fact, I have relatives in Heston, Kansas, which had a really bad Category 5 tornado a number of years ago. And prior to going back to visit, I looked up the amateur radio operators in that area, and I discovered that right after the tornado went through, a lot of new people got licensed. So there is something about amateur radio operators in a disaster area seeing what the amateur operators in that area are doing and wanting to get involved for future disasters.
That's right.
Well, Bonnie, I'm going to thank you for coming, and I'm going to call up Jim Hawley.
I thank the group that's good for presentation before you. There's some very excellent ARES groups in the state of Oregon, and you should be very proud of the areas in which you are representing them. I thought I'd bring it down to the local level. I think this is where you had some questions in regards to this. And what you have before you, and I'll go through this very, very briefly. And this is regards to a county such as Lincoln, but it could be
applied. Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
It could be, excuse me?
Can you identify yourself for the
record? I'm sorry. My name is Jim Hawley. I'm the Emergency Coordinator Director for Lincoln County. And I maintain communications also for the public safety. And I just want to give it information regards how this can be used locally, because you, thank heavens, you asked some questions that were answered by this group. I'd like to narrow it down. On the first page, it gives you a general idea within Lincoln County what this group is. And at the bottom of the page, they do work with Red Cross. They work with the state police. In fact, on the 9th of June, they're working with the game division of the Oregon State Police. They work with the Newport PD early days, and one of the things they also are involved with is damage assessment. On the second page is how you become a member in regards to the organization, and they have six steps they actually have to go through. Everything from background check to training. And the question came up that you had, what happens locally? And if you take a look at the third page, and that's a two-page, one is North Lincoln County, one is Central South Lincoln County, and being the emergency manager, no matter what happens, automatically these people respond to the locations that you see. And are those with special assignments, which means in case the people are not responding, they will go ahead and respond to those locations. And they have been used during major windstorms on the coast. They have been used for flooding. On the next page.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
I have a really silly question for you.
I hope I have a serious answer.
My background is all aviation, where we go by N numbers on airplanes. How do you get assigned these numbers?
The Federal Communications Commission assigns these call signs.
And you get whatever your call sign is put in for.
Yes, but you can also apply for a call sign if there's one that is available. Bonnie gave you her call sign. I've been licensed since 1953, and my call sign is W7VTW. It sticks with you. It's like your name. People know you by name or by your call sign.
Excellent.
If you take a look at the next one, communication support vehicle, we received an award by Oregon APCO, having the only one in the entire state of Oregon has all the communications. On the back page of that, in yellow, you will see that the amateurs are included. And you see what the capabilities of this vehicle is, and I'd like to direct Senator Berger and also Representative Cohen to the back to the front page. Our communications that we have, you'll notice that we have communications with the Oregon State Police, Oregon Department of Forestry, State Fire Marshal's Office, and ODOT. So it's interesting, when I got a document that said that these agencies cannot talk to each other, because we can talk to these people at any time, and we have. Any time that we wish to. But this gives you an idea how important the amateurs are in the county that we have. And the last page that we have, and I'm sure if the time permitted, the gentleman would have given you some technical things that are available. One is APRS, which stands for Automatic Position Reporting System. It's the GPS, which you probably are aware of. Who knows? You may even have a device like this in your vehicle so you don't get lost. One of the neat things we have, or actually two neat things we have, I mentioned to you previously that we use our group for damage assessment. We have the capability of assigning these people and following them any place in Lincoln County, on any road in Lincoln County. And besides knowing how fast they are going, we also know when they get to their destination. And also with amateur radio, another thing that you have, we provide these folks with slow scan television, which means they can take a picture of a house that's been damaged, and through a repeater, which was explained to you, within 30 seconds that picture can be in the emergency operations center, it can be at the Red Cross office, and what we have done, we have put on the computer and shipped it to the governor's command post here in Salem. So you see there's a lot of capabilities that the amateurs do have in the state of Oregon. And I don't think that our county is much different than some of the other counties. So I just want to bring it to you at the local level of what is happening within the state. And I know a couple of you are from the coastal area.
Okay, sure. Questions?
There's four of you, right? There's one, two, three, four. Oh, no, Betsy, five.
Representative Cowan?
We have got to stick together.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, I appreciate you coming over. Jim and I have worked together for a very long time, and I think what we're trying to communicate to the rest of the committee here is that, as usual, I understand about 10% of what Jim's told me, and then I try to go back and read through this and figure it out. But there are fairly extensive networks, there's a very extensive network as far as ham radio is concerned in throughout Lincoln County, and these folks have been called in on a whole variety of emergencies over the years, and I suspect then that there are similar operations in most of the rest of the counties. So maybe you could talk to the committee a little bit, if you would, about the relationships that you have and your relationship with OEM, because basically the effort here is to try to pull this together in some ways to offer some reassurance that there's really quite a lot of backbone out there that we may just need to all better understand actually exists. And then secondarily, if you could address what you, from your perspective, you think needs to be done next from a statewide perspective, working in conjunction with OEM to kind of put some structure around this so that more folks than just somebody who happens to know somebody can see what's in place and where our weak spots might be throughout the state.
Right.
Could you tackle that for me?
The counties work very well together. As the gentleman was speaking, there are some nets. In other words, at certain times of the night, there are check-ins from different parts of the state through different repeaters. However, if those repeaters were down, he also mentioned high frequency. There are certain frequencies which are set up which go into the Oregon Emergency Management depending upon what the atmospheric conditions are. Therefore, counties can go ahead and talk to OEM on these frequencies, and there is a net control which would hold the information down of whether it's priority or whether it's health and welfare, as you mentioned, or whatever the case may be. So there is a link coming into the state from the different counties. And I think what needs to be probably done, and with Bonnie's leadership, since she was appointed or actually elected a couple of years ago, is working with the counties and having them work closer together than what they have in the past.
Follow up. So that's sort of the second part of what we've been talking about here, and we referred briefly, and you and I didn't have a chance to talk before the meeting, the memo that the chair was referring to is essentially asking OEM to kind of spearhead that effort to put some of this together to help us understand what planning is already in place on a county-by-county basis. And I guess I'd like to hear from you about your willingness to, and you think perhaps other emergency managers around the state's willingness to participate in that process, so that we can kind of, as I've been mentioning to you for a number of years, get it out of your heads and on paper where we might know that it exists.
Okay, so what the group is wishing to know how the different, actually probably knowing what each county has to offer, which goes into the state, is this what the committee is looking for, Representative?
It's our job to look at it from a statewide perspective and make sure that we're addressing the needs, that we can respond to things wherever we need to in the state or regionally if we have something more major than the county. And so do you kind of have a sense that that's out there? We just don't really have it all together, that we know that it's all there or not?
Your question is, do we have it together now?
You have HAM networks throughout the state. Is that right?
There are in the state of Oregon some networks right now, yes, that have been put together.
Can we work together with coordination through OEM just so that people are more familiar with what those are?
OEM had a person who has left the state, and there was a void for a period of time, which is now that person has been replaced. And I think that with OEM's guidance working with the folks here in with ARES, that can be put together, yes.
And I think that's what this
committee is supposed to support. I'm going to call on Senator Morset.
What's the significance of your six districts that are shown on page 9? How are the districts organized? Is there
okay, I cannot answer that question. That should be answered from the gentleman from OEM.
We're losing our committee. They have other meetings at 4:30. So,
yes.
Jim, I'm going to thank you very much for coming today, and I hope that you'll be participating in the interim with OEM as they reach out to the counties and finding out what each one is doing, because we really need the expertise of those who are right there in the local areas and how to move forward. So any one last quick question from anyone? All right. Thank you, Jim, very much for coming. Okay, but let me announce a few things to the committee. We have written a letter to the leadership asking that the committee be divided between ocean policy and emergency preparedness and separated out. It just has not been very workable during the session, and so perhaps during the interim, those committees that deal with ocean policy would be dealing with marine reserves, with the potential sanctuary, with the fishing industry, with other really very serious things about the future of the coast. So I think if a committee can just concentrate on those issues, it would probably be much better than trying to work it in to the emergency preparedness. This is our last meeting, but we will be having some type of social get-together before we all separate our ways and go home for the summer. And so I hope that we can fit it into your schedule before the end of the session, that we'll do that. And the other thing is, I'm sure most of you know, but if you didn't, I want to extend our sympathies to the family of Scott Boley. Scott has testified before this committee. He's a fisherman, and those on the coast who know him, hasn't been too long ago that he spoke to our coastal caucus. He served on the Fishery Commission and was one of the most level-headed, common-sense guys that we had to help us communicate well with the fishing community. He was 52 years old and died very suddenly, so we are certainly sorry about that. And my good co-chair, Boone, would you have other things to say to the committee?
Well, that was very sobering news to hear today, and I was very sorry to hear that. I'd like to thank all the committee members for sticking it out with us the new ones. And Senator Johnson, you have been a very quick study. I never had a problem with that, your questions or anything. So hopefully when we if we are allowed to split the committee and continue on, you'll want to continue in one or both of them in those capacity, in this capacity. We've had some four other people who asked to sit on the Emergency Preparedness Committee, and I'll ask them if they would like to join that as well. So
I would about it. Suggest if any of you are interested in serving on either of the committees. I don't know whether they'll let you serve on both, but if you want to request both, you probably should do that fairly soon before the end of the session, and they start thinking about assignments for the interim committee. So,
and I've already requested that both Jim and Judith continue on in their respective capacities, Jim with emergency prep and Judith with ocean policy. That's what they want to do too. So, and Mike,
any,
you're just stuck with this.
Any comments for the good of the order? If not, I'll call the meeting adjourned.